Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel feeding in.
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Here we go, Rusty. Okay? Not everyone is taking the week off. All right? You and I back at it with yet another episode of The Suspendables. Rusty, this is a good week. This is a great guest we have coming up. Okay? Let me just... And he better not make a mistake, okay, on this interview, because I just want to go over quickly, Rusty. You know, usually this is the year in review, easy for you to say. It's minus 38 here, so that's what review sounds like, review, okay? Here's our guest, Rusty, that we've had over since the start of the show. Gary Lehman, we had on Ty Gretzky, Kevin Lowe, James Duthie, Marty McSorley, Kirk McLean, Darren Pang, Larry Robinson, Rick Tocchet, Jeff Cortinel, Bobby Ryan, Dan Quinn, Corey Hirsch, Ron McLean, Ray Whitney, Brian Leach, Haley Wickenheiser, Liam McGuire, of course, the hockey trivia guy, and Wendell Clark. And our guest today, if you are a Canadian and you're a fan of sports, then you are a fan of this guy. He's covered, speaking of long lists, okay, I'm going to go with everything, okay? He's covered everything. Olympics, Toronto Blue Jays. I think he called the Joe Carter home run. I'm going to find out. Lacrosse, curling, baseball, tennis, from Western, where he went to school. The reason I bring that up is because the most annihilated I ever got in my university days was at homecoming at Western. I went down. We want to welcome from Sportsnet, Rob Falls. How are you, Rob? Good to have you, man.
Is this the best you could do at the end of the year? Me?
Yes,
is this?
The big reveal.
Yeah, I heard the list of names and I'm going, oh boy, that's great. This is great. Then you're going, okay, this is me for the end of the year. Oh, well, you look
you're
at
the guy.
Like, 21 hasn't been a good year, really, when you think about it. So we're ending on a downer, like the COVID. Yep. And the only, emotions are down. COVID is up.
Yeah, sure. You and I, of course, well, I've had a connection with everyone in sports over the years. I started back in 99, but you and I got the curling connection going. We interviewed you last week for I do a curling show with Kevin Martin and Warren Hansen. If you're deep into curling, you'll know who Warren Hansen is. And we had Rod on because he's the curling pundit, okay, now for Sportsnet. And Rusty.
Yo.
Okay, so we jump on the interview, and Rob comes on and goes, by the way, Jimmy, love the Suspendables. Boom, book them, okay? So tell us where it all started for you, Rob, because that list is not a lie, and I'm sure I've left some things out about what you've done. And boy, it's a cool list when you start to throw in Olympics and Blue Jays and hockey and curling and baseball. Where did it all start for you?
Well, as I sit here now and we're getting to the end of the year, I was just doing a little math and I'm ending my 47th year since I walked into a radio station as an operator in London, Ontario. So I went to
Holy
Western.
Shit.
Yeah, I went to Western with great intentions of going into science with an eye on perhaps medical school. But again, as you mentioned, Western has a tendency to occasionally drag you in different directions. And sure. I stuck my nose into the campus radio station, and the campus radio station had an affiliation with CFPL in London. And I started there as an operator and then did everything under the sun, including calling the London Knights. I was an on-air announcer. I read news. I did sports. I set up remotes. I did remotes. And then finally, a buddy of mine in London, Barry Smith, a very good friend of mine, finally said, you know what? You're going to have to get out of here. If you want to do something specific and you want to do sports, is what you've told me, you're going to have to go and get another job because you could stay here forever, but they're going to only use you as a jack of all trades. So if you want to be a sports guy, you got to move. So I was very fortunate. Joe Bowen was leaving Sudbury to go to Halifax. I don't know what happened to him. Anything good happen to him after this? No, I'm not sure. So he left Sudbury. I replaced him in Sudbury and did Sudbury Wolves. And I also did Northern Football Conference stuff. We had the Canadian Little League Baseball Championships up there. So it was a great foundation for me. And then from Sudbury, I went to Winnipeg. I went to Montreal, was in Montreal for almost 12 years. And then the network called, and I've been in Toronto with CTV and then Sportsnet with the generations there since 95. So I've been at the network level since 95, but it's been an interesting road. And as you said, along the way, I've been very fortunate because they said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I'll do whatever you ask me to do. So if there was auto racing, I said, yes. If it was an equestrian event, I said, yes. They knew I had background in hockey and football. I did hockey, football. I did basketball. I did tennis. I've done swimming and skiing and skating. It's been varied and it's been a lot of fun to be able to get my fingers into a lot of different sports and to learn a lot about them and to call them. And right now, curling and tennis and hockey were my 1, 2, 3. With the way things are going right now, curling and tennis are kind of, with hockey being wherever hockey is right now. But curling right now takes up most of my time. I'm supposed to go to Alberta next week for the Alberta Men's and Women's Provincials. I'm doing this with my fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. But I just saw something on the internet about Alberta's numbers going up. So I'm going, oh, oh, oh. And then our Grand Slam is supposed to follow up in Camrose, but we're waiting for everything there. So as much as you think you're getting back to normal, you get slapped in the face and you have to back up a little bit. So there, in a very long, convoluted explanation, is my career.
Can you do the curling remotely?
No, we haven't. We've been very fortunate. We've done it live because of the fact we jump around from sheet to update. We have to kind of be there live to keep an eyeball on everything. I imagine we can. I know that the Olympics coming up in Beijing, they're going to call it remotely. Mm-hmm. It's going to make it a little more difficult. Because you just get a real sense of when you're there of what's going on, and you can kind of read faces a little better, and you can see what's going on other ones instead of depending on other people to give you the updates on what's going on.
When you, Sudbury's my hometown, by the way, I was born and raised there, and, the Wolf, I used to, a big night out in Sudbury, of course, was,
Friday night.
Well, you'd go to the hardware store and try on gloves. That was a big night. That's what we did, Or as my buddy said, a big night in Sudbury was going to the grocery store and watch the chickens go around on that rotisserie. That was a huge night. Did they have the when I was a kid? I'm slightly younger than you, but only slightly. Friday nights were the games. Mm-hmm. Rusty, get this, Russ. So when the Wolves scored, they had a clothesline set up. And they would wheel out on this clothesline up over to center ice. It came from above the rafters, a stuffed wolf. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, it was just the funniest looking thing ever. It looked like it was a skit off Second City, and they'd have the howling wolf. And what they forgot about though, fellas, was it would shed and chunks of this thing. Did they have it when you were there, Ron?
Yeah. Not only that, when I was there, they usually hired a high school kid or somebody to run the machine. And so the wolf would come out of the corner to center ice after they scored, right? The crowd would love it. And then the high school guy had to wheel it back in. Well, this one night, Wolves score. It comes out right after the goal. The young kid forgets to hit the brake, and the wolf hits the scoreboard.
Oh, no.
So teeth fall out, the taxidermy teeth fall out, the nose crumples into the scoreboard, and then he wheels it back, and there's one leg waving like this. He pulls it back into the corner, and I'm thinking, oh, well, that was quite a show. Well, nobody told him not to run it out again. The next goal happens by the Wolves. Out of the corner comes, and this poor wolf with the one leg swinging back and forth, the nose down here to center ice. And I just went, there used to be a coach up there who used to go major junior hockey, heavy on the major. And
you remind me of the great Don Whitman from Winnipeg. He talked about this might have been around when you played too, Russ. You talked about calling games in Chicago Stadium where you had to walk way up there and you couldn't, there was no bathroom up there. Right. Mm-hmm. And you, and it was a mile and a half away to go to the bathroom.
No coffee.
And right. You got to lay off. And I think Whitman and Harry Neal were doing a game and Harry Neal was drop dead funny. And Whitman had to go for a leak. So he, and people could see you. It was an open sort of press box, you know, the fans could see you. And so Whitman said, hold up to my jacket here. Okay. I got to have a leak into this cup, okay, or whatever. And Harry said, no problem, Donnie, I'll do that for you. And of course, Harry Neal holds the jacket up. Whitman starts to take a leak and Harry walks away with the jacket.
That's Harry.
100%.
Harry's a funny guy. I remember you guys probably read this. He traded for Jose Charbonneau. And Jose, I think he came from Montreal to Vancouver or something. And he said to Jose, or said to Harry, hey, I'd like you to call me Joe. And he goes, you play well, I'll call you Joe. And they asked him like a few months later, so what are you calling him? He goes, Jose. shows me. Is that right, Jose? I'm not probably pronounce it right, but anyway.
Yeah, Jose. Yeah. Unless you're from Winnipeg, it's Jose.
No, yeah, I think it was Jose. Yeah, Jose.
Yeah, Jose. Hey, Rob, you and I were talking, because I want to ask you about one thing, and then Rusty and a lot of players. Russ has the unique title of playing both in Toronto and Montreal, and every player we ever talked to who's played at one of those two teams or both, you know, including Gary Lehman and Wendell Clark and a bunch of other guys, they talk about how difficult it is to play in that market. This is, and by the way, this is about as fucking serious as I'm going to get. Oh, sorry, Steve, I said serious. Okay. You better bleep that out. They talk about how difficult it is to play there under the microscope. And Rusty's been really forward about it. You covered Russ in Montreal. God, how were those interviews?
Oh, he was brilliant. Let me tell you, there's no better wordsmith than a Cardinal. Let me tell you, both he and his brother. He may have invented pucks in deep. He might have invented that phrase. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Never do it. Yeah. Don't give away the puck. Drove Pat Burns crazy. Dump the puck. Why would I dump the puck?
I always remember Pat Burns. I'd been there since 84. I moved in 84 to Montreal. And I can remember when I started to cover the Canadiens, when I first went into the dressing room, I'd walk into the dressing room of the old Forum and there'd be a blue haze because players still smoked then, right? So you'd walk in to do the post game and you have to do this around all the cigarette smoke. And Lafleur was always one of the go-to guys. And he's sitting there with a butt and he'd go like this.
Yeah.
Hold on. And then he put the butt behind and he'd do the interview. And I thought, we're all going to, you know, catch secondhand complications from this. And then, of course, it cleaned up a little bit. But I can remember going into the coach's room and Pat doing a post-game thing. And the deal was we let the French media go first. We, you know, we gave them ample time, and it was a CBC English guy. Michael Whalen, who was working for TSN at the time, we waited, we bided our time. Yeah. We listened in French and then went, okay, it's our turn. And then I can remember one game after one game, Pat looked at me and he goes, how long you guys want to talk to me for? I said, Pat, probably 2 minutes. Just, we're going to get some clips and we're getting out of here. He said, did you hear what they asked me? I said, yeah. He said, why do they want to know what I had for breakfast? I said, simple, Pat. They have to fill 4 pages whether you play or not. Every French daily had at least 4 pages of Canadian stuff. And they had to fill it. And then, of course, you had French language TV. And so he looked at us and just went, oh, you guys are sweet. I mean, 2 minutes is great. And he'd give us some, you know, pretty good clips that we could use, and off we'd go. But that's the thing with the pressure that is Montreal is under, is there were so many French dailies. They all had passion for the Canadians. They were all trying to find every story possible. And whether it be what the coach has for breakfast on game day or what the players did when they were, they had a little bit of downtime, they had to fill that time. They had, I'd say, at least four or five reporters and or columnists from each paper at every game and pretty much every practice to try to get something on the team. So the pressure there is that a player couldn't turn around. A player couldn't go to a grocery store. Thankfully, this was, I would think Russ would agree, before social media.
Thank God.
Where they, where you could actually go have a beer on Crescent Street, and you just have to say to a bunch of guys, hi, how are you? Thanks very much. It was a good game. But you didn't have to worry about people taking pictures of you, people tweeting out, oh, Russ Courtnell is here with guys. He closed the place. Not that you ever did that. That would never happen. As he's sitting there drinking White Claw. Would never, ever do that. So it was incredibly difficult for any athlete, whether it be an expo or an Alouette, not so much, because they were kind of the level before. It was Canadians, expos, Alouettes. And because the Canadians were basically a religion there, you knew that there was going to be intense pressure. And there's that too in Toronto. And Russ had, I don't know if it was the pleasure of having to deal with both in his career. But, and I imagine every Canadian city is the same, because everybody wants something. They want something new. But Montreal, because it is so much in the fabric of the province, it made it even more difficult for the athlete.
And having Pat as a retired cop didn't help either, because all the police, they would tell Pat every morning he would get all the intel of what happened the night before. So Pat would find out secondhand pretty much everything that was going on. So we had a lot of meetings, the young guys and Pat, and who we were hanging out with, where we were hanging out. So he knew, but thankfully he kept a lot of that out of the media for us.
Russ, what do you remember? I remember when the Canadians had their training camp and started in Sweden and finished in the Soviet Union with a quick trip to Riga. I look back on that. I was just reading something the other day about that trip and the adventures that went on. And I know you scored the winning goal in one of the games. I think it was in Moscow. Was it?
No, the last game, it would have been the second to last game, because the last game we lost in overtime. We had that brawl against the Red Army and we barely got out.
That's when it got ugly.
Yeah, it got really ugly. And I had taken my mom with me on that trip.
That's right.
And she just had the best time. But that game was so scary because they started throwing stuff at us and we had a brawl. The game, I think we were winning 3-1 or something. I can't quite remember the score, but we had to evacuate into our locker room because they were throwing stuff at us. And I was just so worried about my mom up in the stands because she was dressed in head to toe Montreal Canadiens stuff. And then we went out, finished the game after about a 20 to 30 minute delay. They tied it up and won in overtime. And that was the only game I've ever played I wanted to lose because of what was going on in the stands. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life. And then the next day at the airport, they went through all our bags and took everything that was in our bags. That was
an icon. Remember, it was an icon.
Icon. Yeah. They called all those black box lacquer boxes. And I saw what was going on. So I snuck everything out of my check bag into my carry-on. So I had black boxes, cigars, caviar, whatever I had bought, and put it in my carry-on. And I got on the plane and everybody was pissed because they had taken everything.
What were they taking though?
Well, all the stuff we had bought and collected over the 10 days we were there, we were buying all these things to take home for presents for friends and family, these black, beautiful lacquer boxes, jewelry, caviar, cigars, anything that you wanted to take home from Russia as a souvenir, they took away from us.
Well, I can remember Serge Savard had bought. Remember, he bought all that art?
Yeah, he took it all.
He'd gone to a gallery and bought two or three paintings, and he was so proud of this. And all I remember is the paintings sitting by the guy who had gone through his all his stuff and said, can't go,
yeah,
must stay.
Yeah.
And the word icon was thrown around, and that, that was a little grumpy. There was a grumpy bunch there getting on the plane. But he was grumpy, but we were glad we were leaving because the way it finished. Yeah. I was worried for everybody there that last game.
Yeah, it was what a trip. I'll never forget that trip.
Did you tag anyone, Russ, in the brawl, or were you, you didn't pull the sweater over your head?
I was on the bench, and Mike Keane was fighting. Mike Keane was in a fight, and then Shane Corson finished the fight. So this poor guy got the shit kicked out of him. But I was on the bench standing beside Brian Skrulin, and Tikhanov, the coach, stood up on the glass, started yelling at Pat Burns, and Screwy freaking knocked him on his ass with a right.
We got to find video of this, man. There must be video somewhere.
I have a video of the fight somewhere. I've got a friend who sent it to me, and it's scary. I mean, the fights were scary. Diddick fought. It was a 5-on-5 brawl. Yeah, I mean, it was full line. Unbelievable. Yeah.
All I remember with the trip is they lost my luggage as I was getting there. I got it back the last day we came back.
Oh no! Oh no! Yeah. The great luggage story loss is the guy checking in at the airport and telling the girl, you know, he says, "Listen, I'm going to Toronto, but I want this bag to go to Salt Lake, and I want my other bag here to go to Vancouver." And she goes, "Well, we can't do that." He says, "You did it last time."
I'll never forget that trip. The food was so bad.
Oh, horrible.
I mean, we were complaining the whole time, but that was the first McDonald's that year. They opened a McDonald's in Moscow. And we went that day. There's four or five of us. We went, and the lineup was 3 hours. And we're like, oh, no. And every employee in McDonald's was from Montreal. They had brought over them to teach the Russians how to prepare the food. They came running out and grabbed us, and we went in, and I've never enjoyed a meal more than that day. Oh my God, it was so good. We ordered so much food, and it cost barely anything. And that was our best meal on that that swing.
Russians aren't really known for their culinary expertise.
Now it is. Now the food there is quite something. It's excellent. And it's really, I mean, that was in 1990
or 91.
Yeah. So, you know, lots has changed since then. There are still communists back then.
Rob, well, I wanted to ask you, so, you know, covering that team, Gordy Wilson, who you would know is the color guy for the radio broadcast in Ottawa, great guy. And Dean Brown, and Gordy, of course, the Ottawa, the Sens rivalry with Toronto. And Gordy always said it was impossible to try and get interviews. I don't want to throw him under the bus, but I will, you know, that even the team was very difficult to work with to try and get what you normally would be able to get with any other team. How was it as a press guy, Rob, in Montreal, for example? Can you give us an idea of how that would be different than if you worked in Winnipeg?
You know, we had to go through channels. We had to, you know, but for the most part, they were fairly accommodating back then. Right? It really tightened up. I'm trying to think what year. Probably mid-90s, it really tightened up to get players to come out to do interviews. Before, the team would go in. You'd wait 5 minutes. They'd open up the room. Off you went. You could do your interviews.
Right.
It then became a little more, I think, in the mid-90s, where it was more and more difficult because of, I think, the people wanting more. The French media had to do theirs. There was all of a sudden RDS was in the mix. TSN was in the mix. There was CTV, CBC, TVA. There were all these different channels wanting to get interviews. So they'd probably scrum the coach, and then they'd try to pull out the players as they could. And I think that lasted until maybe mid to late 90s, when all of a sudden the press guys said, okay, we'll bring them out. We'll bring them out. And then you had to make your requests. So I just think the request and the number of media increased to the point that they really had to make a change. They had to do something different. And it became difficult to get the inside the different side of a player, as opposed to just the hockey side, to find out, you know, their interests and stories about what they like to do. And that's what they're complaining about now, right? Is that they don't get to know the player. Very rarely do you get a chance to discover the personality of the players that play the game, because, you know, for the most part, they're very well protected by their media guys. And it's difficult. And the demand, because there's so much media out there that wants to talk to them, whether now it be newspaper, television, radio, you know, the digital services, the podcast, everything now, the demands have increased, I'd say tenfold.
Right. What's the most difficult part of your job, Rob? Because you look at guys like yourself who are seasoned veterans in it, and when you watch you call games, whatever it is, whatever sport, Olympics or figure skating or whatever, it kind of just flows like lava, you know, when you guys do this. And then I tried to do it myself one day, like just pissing around at the radio station. I was going, I could do play-by-play or color or something like that. And I was never more impressed with guys like you who do that job. What's the toughest part of it, Rob?
Research.
Oh, yeah.
Getting the info now. You know, when I first started, there was no internet. There was basically, you had to go to the library and look up stuff in the newspaper on microfiche and do things like that. Talk to a lot of people. Had I studied this much when I was in university, you'd be talking to Dr. Robert Paul right now. Right. And I would have cured COVID by now. but because I've done so many different things, I've had to do a lot more research. I've had to do a lot more talking to people about what they do and how the games are played. As to doing play-by-play, it's reps. And Russ will tell you this, it's, you know, if you want to be a good face-off circle, you got to practice.
Right.
I tell young kids now, turn the sound down, grab the lineup and call the game and throw a tape recorder on. For those that want to be anchors, I say sit in front of a mirror and read the newspaper. Read it out loud. It helps you with your inflection. It helps with the way your expressions are when you do on-camera stuff. It's all about repetition and practice. I've been very fortunate to work with some great analysts too, mm-hmm. that have had the willingness to say, this is the way our sport runs. This is, you know, what you should look for. And these are people we should talk to. Byron McDonald was great when I did swimming at the Olympics in 92. I started to work with him in 90. CTV kind of pegged me in 90 to do some network stuff. And they had me do swimming, and I got to know Byron, and Byron introduced me to the right people, said, watch this kid. Byron has an encyclopedic knowledge about swimming, and he's done everything as from an athlete to a coach to a broadcaster. He knows everybody. So he was brilliant in helping me, and we found a rhythm. When we did a swimming event, it was, you set the lanes, give me the first 5 meters to just say what the event is and who's first out of the water. You have 40 meters to explain what's going on. Give me the last five so I can tell everybody who's leading at the touch. When they do the flip, it's your pool again, but give me the last five to call the race.
Oh, cool.
And we got into a nice rhythm there, and that's what worked. And if you talk to your analysts and get to know them, same thing when you do speed skating, they know the sport. You're the who and the what thing going on. They know the where and the why. So you let them do their thing, and if you can keep it clean and neat, it always sounds really good.
Yeah, cool. Interesting, yeah. In your career, was I right? Did you call the Joe Carter home run?
No, but I was.
I thought I wasn't, that, right?
No, but in 92, I was in Atlanta with CTV, because in 92, on the clinching game against Atlanta, CBS had a presidential debate. So they weren't going to start the game until first pitch. So they had to move the debate up a little so they could have the debate. So Rod Black and I went to Atlanta to do a pregame show before the game started.
Yeah.
And so my first job was I did some interviews before in the pregame show, and I was going to do postgame in the winning locker room. And so late in the game, if you recall, Jays were leading. So I trudged down to the Jays dressing room. They're putting up plastic.
Yeah,
they're starting to wheel in the champagne. They're bringing in a big box of hats or t-shirts. Then all of a sudden the Braves come back and tie it. They kick us all out of the locker room. Now I'm standing in the corridor. I'm looking down at all I can see is first base. This much of first base.
Right.
And I could hear the radio. They've got the radio blasting through the stadium. So I'm sitting there going, okay, this is great. Now I'm kind of waiting to see. All I can see and hear, I hear the call, and I can hear that Otis Nixon has dropped down a bunt. I can see Joe Carter standing at first. I can see the ball flip to him, and then Carter start to jump up and down in my little window that I can see. And, of course, it goes crazy. Well, the Jays fans who are there go crazy. All of a sudden, I get told, you go to the field. We're going to send Rod into the dressing room. And I went, okay, he can ruin his suit. But I had, if you take a look at any of the video from that show, I wore an old suit to Atlanta, knowing that I was supposed to go in the dressing room. Then all of a sudden I realized I'm not. And I have a wrinkled lapel out because I figured I'm not even taking the suit home. I'm going to throw this suit out. As soon as I end up having to do the post game show and I'm wearing this wrinkled suit and I'm going, that's it. Big time TV, Falsey. Well done. But in 93, I was asked to do, again, to be on field for 93, but I was in Halifax doing an equestrian event. Yeah. So I watched it in the hotel in Halifax and felt the entire hotel sway when Carter hit the home run. You could feel it vibrate. It was the most remarkable thing.
Yeah, cool. That's certainly got to be a highlight for you. When you look back, Rob, what are give me your top three.
Probably Tewksbury's gold medal in Barcelona.
Oh, the swim? In
100 meter. Yeah. So that, well, it was early in my career. It was my first Olympics. So it always stands out to me. That was one of my special events. Probably John Montgomery in Vancouver winning. And, you know, that was prior, you know, and that was quite an event. And of course, the gold medal. Probably with him walking through the village. Remember when he got the pitcher of beer from some fan and was drinking beer out of the pitcher in Whistler. So that call was, that stands out. And I'm just trying, as the most remarkable, you know what, I'm going to put, and this is, again, as I said, when we did Inside Curling, I'm not going to blow smoke, but Kevin's final event going out and then retiring. Right. And I swear that he knew going into that event that this was his last event.
Right.
And then to keep it in, to keep cool and end up winning it. Wow.
Yeah, cool.
There's a lot of things there. You know, after I get off with you, I'll probably sit there, start to go, well, I could have told him this. I could have told him this.
Yeah. That's good. We'll bring it back. Rusty's mother, I think, was a curler, by the way.
Yeah. My mom and my stepdad both played. They curled. And my mom, when I was a little kid, curled downtown and in Victoria, and used to take my younger brother and I, who weren't in school, and stick us upstairs in the smoking lounge.
Yeah.
And we would sit there, you know, in the window and watch her, you know, curl. And she was quite a curler. She had an eight ender.
Oh, wow. Listen to you go, Rusty.
Yeah. And my stepdad played and they loved it. Actually, I think that's how they kind of met. Like, they rekindled their relationship. They knew each other as kids. And then my mom, he was divorced. My mom was a widow and they met at curling.
No kidding.
So that's how they got back together. Yeah. And then continued on curling for years and years. They
love on the rocks.
Love on the rocks. Oh, yeah. Okay. There you Robbie, go. Baby. There we go. I love that. Boom. Mic drop. Yeah.
Fuck, Rob, we may need a new host. So, let me know. You're still there.
I'll tell you how clever you are to use the term on the rocks. That works very well with Russ. Okay. That's how he spends 8 hours a day. Okay. Something on the rocks. Okay.
Jimmy's jealous because he crossed the finish line a little early. About 10 years ago. Exactly. Hit the finish line. Fucking speed dial.
Stop it. Okay. Talking about highlights of the year. I look back at it this year and it's not your kind of usual thing, Rob, about what's sticking out in sports. Things like betting have just, you know, have reached the forefront here, but the mental health thing comes on the heels of Russ and his two brothers, Bruce and Jeff, Well, you tell us, Russ, how you've kind of reintroduced your charity, because I think there were two significant things that happened with mental health was Simone Biles pulling out of the Olympics and Naomi Osaka pulling, I think it was the French Open, that they and both citing anxiety, stress, and mental health issues. So bring us up to speed, first of all, Rusty, with your charity. And then we'll get Rob's comments.
So, Rob, my brothers and I have raised a lot of money for mental health. Our dad committed suicide when we were young. And in 03, 04, we built the Archie Cortinel Center in Victoria, British Columbia. It's emergency psychiatric center. And then long-term care in 2011. And we decided to create a society. So it's the Cortinel Society. And now what we're doing is we're raising money across Canada and parts of the United States, because some of our friends obviously live in the United States, and we're giving grants to grassroots mental health facilities and centers. And so we're helping out people who are helping people who are struggling. And we just started this new society and we've just launched. So that's what the three of us have been focusing on charity-wise. Unfortunately, we're part of the suicide team. There's many of us out there that have been affected by it, by loved ones and family and friends. And so anyways, that's our focus. And so now we're trying to help as many people as we can and as many organizations. So we're excited about that. And that's what we've been doing since 03, actually. Before that, we were, Jeff and I had charity events in the 90s for Canuck Place, which helps terminally ill children in Vancouver. And of course, they come from all over to stay at Canuck Place. But that's where we're at with mental health. And we all know it's been a tough go, and it's been tougher since the pandemic. And it's really, really affected a lot of people. I live in LA and we're really lucky here because you can get outside and the weather's nice. But in some of these cities and towns, especially in Canada, it's been really tough during the winter months because a lot of people have been stuck inside and not been able to do what they allow them to do. And it's really made for a lot of people struggling. And so we're just trying to help out as much as we can.
Well, that sounds great. And with all the best with the society. And now I've never ever told anybody this. And you guys are the first one. My uncle committed suicide. So I know the pain and I know what it is to have that. And the whole mental health issue, I understand completely, because this last 2 years, it has certainly changed how people consider mental health. And I even told people that it affected me. It changed, you know, I don't think I was as nice as I was. I think I became a grumpy grandpa. I think I was, shorter to snap because I just had nothing to do. You were doing the same thing day after day. And I think mental health now and the issues around it have become very important. And when there's extra pressure of being in the public eye or being under pressure because of a pandemic where you can't do anything. For many people, they couldn't go to work. They had to sit at home and wait. I was the same way. I had to sit at home and wait and hope that somebody would call. And I didn't work for 15 months. I waited from March 2020 until April 21 to do anything. And it weighs on you. And the whole issue of mental health is so very important now because of the stresses that I believe have been added on over the years, and with everything with the social media and the instant you have to know something right away, and you've got Instagram, TikTok, and all these things that adds extra pressure.
Rob, what's your opinion? Because you are the barometer for this. I brought up those two. What I thought when I, seven or eight things, you get the usual Tom Brady winning and Tiger Woods coming back and Phil Mickelson win the PGA. So it's kind of the story of the older guys. And then these two issues of Naomi Osaka pulling out of that tennis event. I think it was the French or Wimbledon, one of the two.
Yeah.
and Simone Biles. And Naomi Osaka, in so many words, blamed the media. She blamed the people who were interviewing her. She said, "I've had enough. I can't take it." She became very vocal and was very outspoken about, "You don't know what happens to me when you do this and when I'm at home." Part of me, Rob, when I heard that story, I fell into the same sort of line as other people, and I regret it now and changed it, going, "Hey, suck it up, man. You know, you're a billion-dollar athlete. You're going to be a, you know, a $500 million athlete. Yes, I, you know, okay, no kidding, it's stressful." And then I, when I kept following the story, I went, "Oh my God, are the press people to blame for that, Rob? What are they allowed to ask these players? What shouldn't they? What should they do? How should they handle it?"
Nothing is off limits anymore. You know, you heard all the stories about, you know, way back in the 50s and 60s when the Canadians would travel on train back and forth and all the stuff that went on, and or baseball players in the 50s and 60s. I mean, Mickey Mantle's story has been very well documented. Mickey was a bit of a hound, and he liked going out and enjoying the New York nightlife. But it didn't get reported by the media. You know, basically the next day it was, Mick's not feeling well. Ha ha, we know. Wink, wink. And then they just asked him after, "Mick, why didn't you hit a home run? Or how come you're only, you know, 2 for 3? Now, nothing is offside. Content is king. They have to fill up all this space. They have so many people asking so many different things that I think the pressure there is increased enormously. Before, you know, maybe you had a couple of TV stations and a newspaper to deal with. Now you have newspaper, radio, and as I mentioned, you've got digital services, you've got streaming things you have to worry about. It's difficult to find time to be you, and to have that time to do maybe just nothing, just sit there and contemplate or read a book. Or now, tennis is a very individual sport. It's difficult because it's just you on the court. They are surrounded by a lot of people that help out. They're surrounded by their, you know, massage therapists, and they've got their coaches, and they've got many times nutritionists and a lot of people that go with them. But it's an individual sport, and that applies extra pressure because you don't get paid unless you win. It's not unlike golf that way, too. You don't get paid unless you win or perform. Right. And I think that adds an awful lot to it. And then when you don't perform, you have to sit in a room with, you know, 30 or 40 people who are going to say, "Why didn't you perform? You know, or and what did you do there?"
Yeah. So what's allowed, Rob?
I always feel you ask about the match. You ask about pivotal points in the match. You ask if your training's good. You ask related to the sport they're in. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just my opinion. Now, there are going to be people say, "Well, we want to get the deep dive. We want to know what's going on." Well, that's all well and good if the athlete wants to offer it up. But I think when you're covering an event, you're covering an event and the athlete that's in it. Their actions on the ice, on the field, on the tennis court should dictate your line of questioning and where you go with it.
Good one.
When you stray away from that, you're going into some territory that perhaps the athlete doesn't want to go in. But now with the fact that an athlete doesn't have a moment to themselves, because if they go out and they're having a fun time with a bunch of people, there's somebody putting it on Facebook or Twitter right away saying, "Look at this and watch what they're doing." And then, of course, that becomes a line of questioning many times afterwards. "Oh, you were out partying at such and such a place." "Yes, I was. You know, but that was 2 days ago. And I had a very good practice, and I thought I played a good match."
Right.
This is just Rob speaking, that I just feel that what the athlete does on their playing surface is what you ask. And if you want to do an in-depth and the athlete allows you, then you have a time to do a little more on the personal side of the person that you see compete.
But not in a scrum.
I don't think that's the place for it, because All of a sudden, you know, somebody says, "Well, I hear you're dating so-and-so." Well, then all of a sudden 25 people go, "Really? Well, I want to hear the answer to this one."
after they won the French Open. Yeah,
and I understand the pressure all athletes go through, because the pressure to perform, and then there's got you have to talk about it afterwards, whether you perform or not.
Right.
I always found the toughest interview you did was with an Olympic athlete when they didn't achieve what they felt they could have achieved.
Oof.
Because for the most part, they were amateurs. This was the pinnacle of their career. They only have an opportunity every 4 years to try to get it done. And when it doesn't happen, they're devastated. And you know, the emotion's raw. And try to say, okay, how do you feel? Well, guess what? You can tell how they feel.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see it on their face. You know, you see it on the face. When I was doing a lot of junior hockey, you could see it after the Memorial Cup was handed out. Here are these kids, 17, 18, 19, on the bench in tears. Because that's what it meant to them, not to be able to hoist that Memorial Cup.
Right.
Or any cup, for that matter.
Yeah, it's like life-altering when you win a championship, but it's also as life-altering when you don't live up to the expectation, you know?
And that's when you have to be able to have people around you who will help you handle it. You've got to have a nice support unit around it.
That's why Jim's in a one bedroom by himself.
Exactly. Yeah. Listen, I never lived up to the expectation of making it to grade 7 from grade 6. It was very disappointing. Let's talk about the year before we let you go. This is great, Rob. You have worked your way into being a co-host. Okay.
Oh, there we go.
I make that freaking decision, Russ. Okay. I make that decision.
Yeah. Who hired you?
I hate when mom and dad fight. There we go.
Yeah, it's our first fight. I don't know. Let's go hockey, Rob. Looking back on the year.
My Montreal Canadiens stuff.
Is it all you have, fan? There we go.
Oh, in that closet over that shoulder, I've got all my Canadian paraphernalia. I was going to hang it up, but I went with the Canadian Hockey League because I figured that showed me no bias at all.
Sure.
But I've got all my Montreal Canadiens jerseys in there. I have a Béliveau. I've got a Lafleur. And I have a Richard jersey, unsigned, but it's in a nice zippered bag here with a letter on it. So,
are they game worn?
The Béliveau one is.
Wow.
That'll be worth a fortune.
The Lafleur one is just one of the ones you could get signed. And the Richard one was just a nice one that they did up. And I saw it on a silent auction. I just went, got to have this one. So
I just sold a Keon jersey for $15,000.
Did you? Shut up.
Game worn. Yeah.
Keon for 15 large.
Yeah. 15 US.
Wow. Wow.
As my other buddy told me, he goes, it's worth more than 15. If the guy paid you 15 for it.
Right.
I went, shit.
Right.
But he offered me 15. So that Béliveau is probably worth more than that.
Yeah. It's one of my treasures right there. He's one of those special guys. I grew up in Hamilton, so I should have been a Leaf fan, but I was a Canadiens fan. And Béliveau was always my favorite player growing up because I'm that vintage. And I had the opportunity to meet him a number of times. And that was something special when he got to know your name.
What a great man.
Yeah. When he knew your name, he'd say, hello, Robbie. And I go, how you doing? And we did an event in Sudbury. When I was in Sudbury, Toe Blake and Al Arbor were both from that area. So they had a big night celebrating Toe and Al. And they brought in the Stanley Cup. The Béliveau came up. They had all the Islander people came up. Bill Torrey was there. And it was just a spectacular night. My wife sat between Béliveau and Toe Blake and made sure Toe ate, because Toe was not 100% then and was. So she made sure he ate all his dinner and then told me as we were driving in the car, you know, Béliveau calls, I'm leaving. And I went, you know, go ahead, off you go. I would have no problem because there was a great story. My wife left me for Jean Béliveau. So, you know.
What a man. What a legend.
And I think I only hearken back to that because I thought the Canadians were the story up until May and June and July, when you take a look at the way that they had to run the NHL at the start of the year, with the Canadian division and all the different divisions, and then Montreal making that spectacular run and beating teams they weren't supposed to even be in the same arena with. When they bounced Toronto in 7, how many people saw that? They handled Vegas. They went through and got to it. And as a Canadiens fan and talking to my other Montreal fans, they all went, this is unbelievable. This is this is like a gift. And they kept waiting for the gift to, you know, you having to return the gift. And they, when they got against Tampa, I think we all felt that, you know, they pretty much run the racetrack and they were pretty much done. But what a story that was for last season. And of course, Tampa winning back to back was brilliant. They're just a brilliantly coached and managed team.
What do you say before we let you go, looking back at other sports in the year, I've written a few down and we nicely covered the mental health thing, which is, I just think was huge through the year with all those people and on a, you know, a bad side, there's, you know, so many of these abuse allegations by guys. The beach story was terrible, but what do you think is bigger, Rob?
Olympic women's soccer was a huge
Olympic one. Women's soccer.
The fact that the gold medal that they got, I thought was huge for the sport, huge for women's sport. And I can remember watching, getting up early to watch it and just standing. I stood during the shootout because, you know, me standing up during a shootout being, 20,000 miles away was certainly going to help. but I was sitting there watching it with my, standing there watching it with my 5-year-old granddaughter. And she got to see women doing something at the highest level. And I believe it resonated a little bit with her. I know she's only 5, but I think she was very pleased that it was women. And, you know, we were cheering for women doing the best that they could possibly do. And they did. I thought that was a remarkable achievement. And it was great to be a Canadian on that moment.
I have 2 daughters that are soccer players, or one now doesn't play, but they both started at 5. And so for sure, you watching with your granddaughter is going to be a lasting memory and probably get her into the game. So I can appreciate that as a dad, a father of 2 really good soccer players, that that'll carry throughout her life. If she does play some, she might not want to play, but that'll be a memory she'll cherish, I'm sure.
Where's your daughter? Is she at UCLA on a full ride?
USC soccer, but she just got invited to try out for the U20 Canadian ladies soccer team. And awesome. She goes to Toronto in January. There's 24 Canadians invited for 20 spots for the this year's or next year's World Cup.
Awesome.
So we're excited. And our oldest made the U20 Canadian team and went and played and for Canada. So and we're excited for Brooklyn. And hopefully with all this COVID going on, that they go and have the tryout, because that's the only way they're going to be able to pick the team, I guess.
I might have to get my children on the line and say, listen, I've met a bunch of other kids.
Yeah, you got to go. You got to go.
You got to go.
Yeah, your time is done. Thanks very much. We've had a great run, but it's all done. There's the door. Don't let it hit you where the good Lord split you. Yeah.
How about, Rob, before you go, I love Tiger coming back. That was great. I love Phil. I'm a golf nut. I love Phil.
Which comeback, the car accident or actually when he came back?
Well, both.
Yeah.
Both. Yeah. He's a newer, softer Tiger. They interviewed him saying, are you going to come back to the PGA? And he kind of like, he said, are you kidding me, man? I've got my leg, literally. Okay. He thought he was going to get his leg amputated and playing with his son. He's like, I could give a shit. That's the sense I got from Tiger on that. But what do you think, Rob, about this is a new experiment they did. I'm not sure if I like it or not. I didn't when I first saw it, where you've got the Manning brothers, Peyton Manning and what's his face, Eli. They're just, so, Russ, I don't know if you've seen this.
Yeah, it's huge.
Do you like it, Rob? Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't want to throw you under the...
I was at the... I'll interrupt for a second, then I'll let Rob answer what he thinks from his point of view. But I was at Matthew Stafford's house, the quarterback, a couple weeks ago for the Rams, and there was about 10 guys. We were celebrating Andrew Whitworth's 40th birthday, and they were all talking about it. And I just sat back and listened, and they said it is off the charts good. And
really?
Yeah, it's gaining momentum every week. And so that is coming from, you know, their peers. So there you go.
What do you think, Rob? Looking ahead, do you think?
I think we're going to see more of it. We're even seeing it on our network. We have a guy, Steve Dangle Glenn, and he'll watch the game, a Leaf game. He's a diehard. He has a Leaf shrine in his basement.
Yeah.
but he'll watch the game and you can watch him watch the game and react to everything going on. And then he, you know, he has a chance to talk to other people, but he got into like triple hundreds, thousands watching with him during one of the playoff games last year. we're going to see more in this where you can, so you get to be selective. You can watch Eli and Peyton and their guests, and it's fun and it's entertaining because Eli and Peyton still talk about the game as well as having a pretty good guest. And they've got a real nice Rolodex they can work from for their guests.
Right.
But then you can also go back to the game and you can address the game if you want. I think it's great in short bursts because you go and you get, okay, ha, 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 that's great. And I'll always watch the game a little bit. Then you go back to it because many times they'll go back to a pivotal play and you'll hear what two guys who know the game inside and out have to say. And their guests usually aren't too shabby either. So it's fun to watch. I think we're going to see more of that, you know, because you can do it now with Zoom and with all these different availabilities to get online while the event is happening. I know it's sports that we're going to be experimenting more and more with it, and it's going to be interesting. And you touched on it. Sports betting is going to be something that's going to add maybe another, like you're going to see an Eli and Peyton thing, but with wagerers talking during the game.
Jim's been doing this for years, but he's been watching couples in their bedrooms and
wagering on that. Hasn't been doing that.
No wagering.
Just commenting.
He's just been watching
to see what I put up with Rob. We almost went the whole hour here without Russ pounding me like a post. He went there a little bit.
I think I'm going to have to shower after this now. I don't feel clean anymore.
It's not on cable. It's I don't know where he signs up, but apparently it's quite entertaining.
I love to ask press guys, Gary Galley, who Russ played with, Gary Galley, the first time he did it in Ottawa, we were on the same station.
Yeah.
And poor Galley, you know, Gabby, they called him, right? He talks so much.
No, Gaga.
Gaga, okay. Gaga. Anyway, he thought they had gone to commercial, Rob, but this makes a guy who's in broadcast just shrivel up with you. Oh, no. Oh, no. He thought he was muted, thought he was on commercial, and then proceeded to drop a million F-bombs while it went across air. I've embarrassed myself several times, okay? Calling the winningest coach in all of hockey, folks, not just junior hockey. Brian Kilway has won more games than anyone, okay? Coach of 67s. We brought him on for an interview, okay? And I called him John Kilray.
John? Okay?
Yeah, John Kilray.
That is so much like Brian. I can see the confusion, Brian.
Fulzy, not only that, but I crescendoed on the name. I was like, Johnny, we've got to ask you. Or I was just like, I was trying to be cool. Rob Falls, this was fantastic, man.
I'm glad we were able to review the year. I thought we went right through the year perfectly. I think we covered every major event from January to December.
Sure we did. Yeah, sure we did. That was awesome, Rob, to have you on. Well, your stories are better. That's why. Thanks a lot. You have worked your way in. We've got several choices. Okay. And you may get a call from me.
So I'm on the list somewhere.
Yeah. You're on my radar now for sure. So
I'll talk to you in 2022.
Rob, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Take care, guys. Have a happy new year.
Happy new year, man.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to The Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.